As a result, they're booked solid, an impressive achievement, particularly in a soft construction market. When purchasing something of value, customers want to know exactly what they can expect. They want their experience to be predictable. Unexpected surprises can provide a customer with a great experience, but if you're not able to deliver what the customer expects in a predictable manner, it doesn't matter how many bonuses you offer. People love pleasant surprises, but they hate to be caught off guard. There are three primary factors that influence the predictability of an offer: uniformity, consistency, and reliability. Uniformity means delivering the same characteristics every time. Coca-Cola was one of the first large companies to combine solid marketing with large-scale product uniformity. Product uniformity in the beverage industry is an astounding feat. Creating, bottling, and distributing soda is an incredibly complex logistical process. A little too much sugar or flavoring, slightly more air, or an introduction of bacteria can drastically alter the final product. No one wants their favorite soda to taste different every time they drink it. When you open a can of Coke, you expect exactly the same product as you had the last time, no matter where you are in the world. Even if 0.01% of the cans of Coca-Cola sold were flat or sour, people would quickly stop buying. Consistency means delivering the same value over time. One of the reasons New Coke failed in the mid-1980s was that customers expected Coke to taste a certain way, and the company delivered something completely new under the same name. Violating consistency led to a swift decline in sales, followed by a swift increase when the Coca-Cola company restored the original formula. Violating the expectations of loyal customers is not the way to success. If you're offering something completely different, present it as something new. Reliability means being able to count on delivery of the value without error or delay. Ask Microsoft Windows users what they hate most about their computers, and they'll always tell you system crashes. Unreliability is a huge frustration for a user, particularly when predictability is at a premium. How would you feel if you were building a house and a contractor didn't show up on time? Improving predictability has major reputation and value perception benefits. The more predictable your standard offering is, the more you'll be able to increase the perceived quality of the products and the services that you offer. Throughput. Throughput is the rate at which a system achieves its desired goal. By understanding and improving the process you use to actually create and deliver the value you've promised to your customers, you can improve quality and customer satisfaction. Throughput is a measure of the effectiveness of your value stream. Throughput is measured in the formula units divided by time. The more results you create per unit of time, the higher the throughput. In order to measure throughput, you need a clearly defined objective. Dollar throughput is a measure of how quickly your overall business system creates $1 of profit. Assume a standard time unit, like an hour or a day or a week or a month. How many dollars does your business system produce on average during that time? The faster your business produces dollars of profit, the better. Unit throughput is a measure of how much time it takes to create an additional unit for sale. How long does it take to go from raw materials to a finished unit rolling off the production line? The faster the throughput, the more units you'll have to sell, and the faster you'll be able to respond to new demand for those products. Satisfaction throughput is a measure of how much time it takes to create a happy, satisfied customer. It takes restaurants like Chipotle Mexican Grill approximately 3 minutes from the time the customer enters the restaurant to the time they receive their order. The less time it takes to create a happy customer, the more customers you can serve in an hour, and the more happy customers you can create every day. The longer customers have to wait, the fewer customers you can serve in an hour, and the less satisfied they will be with the experience. The best way to begin increasing throughput is to start measuring it. How long does it take for your business system to produce a dollar of profit? How long does it take to produce another unit to sell or a new happy customer? If you don't know your throughput, make it a priority to find out. Measuring throughput is the first step to improving it. Duplication. Duplication is the ability to reliably reproduce something of value. Factory production is the quintessential example of duplication. One design, many copies. Instead of reinventing the wheel over and over again, duplication allows you to design the wheel once, then make as many of them as you wish. The better your ability to duplicate your offer, the more value you can provide. The more time and effort it takes to make something, the less available it tends to be. Duplication allows you to make copies of your offer quickly and inexpensively, making it more widely available in a cost-effective way. Consider this book. In the olden days, books used to be copied and bound by hand. It would take a scribe months, sometimes years, of full-time work to copy a single book. As a result, books were extremely expensive and difficult to obtain. How times have changed. It was written only once, and recorded only once, but via the wonder of large-scale printing equipment and recording equipment, it can be reproduced quickly, reliably, and inexpensively. As a result, tens of millions of copies can be made and distributed all over the world and can be purchased for a few dollars. That's the magic of duplication. The internet has made duplication of some forms of value even easier. As Kevin Kelly remarked in his essay, Better Than Free, the internet is essentially an enormous, inexpensive copy machine. When I write a post for personalmba.com, it can be duplicated by my web server for next to nothing and delivered to a reader on the other side of the world almost instantly. Duplication of information, text, images, music, and video, is essentially free. The value of this information, however, can be quite significant. If you want to create something that you can sell without your direct involvement, the ability to duplicate your offer is essential. If you have to be personally involved with every customer, there's an upper limit on the number of customers you can serve in a given amount of time. Combining duplication with automation allows you to deliver value to more people and close more sales as a result. Multiplication. McDonald's knows how to duplicate Big Macs. Starbucks knows how to duplicate triple soy vanilla lattes. Here's what McDonald's and Starbucks have in common. Both businesses can duplicate entire stores, which is why there are thousands of each all over the world. Multiplication is duplication for an entire process or system. McDonald's began as a single restaurant in California. Starbucks began as a single coffee shop in Seattle. By learning to duplicate the entire business system that is a McDonald's or Starbucks store, each company opened new possibilities for growth. Walmart did the same thing. Starting with a single store in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Walmart multiplied at an astounding rate, spreading rapidly across the Midwest, then nationally, then globally. Walmart's success lies in multiplying two interconnected systems, stores and distribution centers. Distribution centers multiply the ability to receive inventory from suppliers and deliver it to stores. Stores replicate a proven system of receiving, displaying, and selling that inventory to paying customers. Multiplication is what separates small businesses from huge businesses. There's an upper limit on what any single business system can produce. By creating more identical business systems based on a proven model, multiplication can expand a business's ability to deliver value to more customers. That's the major benefit of franchising. Instead of reinventing a business model, opening a franchise helps multiply a model that already works. The easier it is to multiply your business system, the more value you can ultimately deliver. Scale. Think of a skilled quilter who specializes in creating quilts by hand. Assuming each quilt takes a week to produce, having one active customer a week is great. Creating and delivering a single quilt to a single customer is no problem at all. Having two customers at once is challenging. Customer number two has to wait until customer number one is served. If the quilt maker receives 1,000 orders in a single day, that's a huge issue. There's no way to keep up with the demand without keeping customers waiting, which creates an undesirable level of scarcity. Scale is the ability to reliably duplicate or multiply a process as volume increases. Scalability determines your maximum potential volume. The easier it is to duplicate or multiply the value provided, the more scalable the business. Contrast the handmade quilt business with a scalable business like Starbucks. Assume the average Starbucks has the capacity to serve 100 beverages an hour. Any demand above that and the store starts getting overcrowded. The solution? build another Starbucks, even if it's right across the street, not an uncommon sight in cities like New York. Scalability is typically limited by the amount of required human involvement in a process. Starbucks is able to enhance their ability to duplicate lattes via automation. Starbucks employees are involved in making drinks, but the process is semi-automated. A machine actually makes the espresso. Many of the ingredients are prepared ahead of time, and so on. The overall level of human attention or intervention that's required to make a good drink is actually quite small, which is why Starbucks can crank out so many drinks every hour. If your goal is to create a business that doesn't require your direct daily involvement, scalability should be a major consideration. Products are typically the easiest to duplicate, while shared resources, like gyms, are easiest to multiply. Humans don't scale. Individual people only have so much time and energy each day, which is a constraint that doesn't change with the volume of work to be done. On the contrary, as we'll discuss later in performance load, a person's effectiveness usually goes down as the demands on them increase. As a result, services are typically difficult to scale, since they tend to rely heavily on the direct involvement of people to deliver value. As a general rule, the less human involvement required to create and deliver value, the more scalable the business. Accumulation. At this very moment, a Toyota engineer somewhere in the world is making a very small change to the Toyota production system, one of the most efficient manufacturing systems in the world. Alone, the change may not look like much, a small tweak, a slight restructure, a bit of material or effort saved. Taken together, however, the effects are huge. Toyota employees implement over 1 million improvements to the Toyota production system every year. It's little wonder that Toyota is now the world's largest and most valuable automotive manufacturer. Small, helpful, or harmful behaviors and inputs tend to accumulate over time, producing huge results. According to the book Lean Thinking by James P. Womack and Daniel T. Jones, Toyota's approach is based on the Japanese concept of Kaizen, which emphasizes the continual improvement of a system by eliminating muda, or waste, via many small changes. Small improvements, consistently implemented, inevitably produce huge results. Accumulation isn't always positive. Think of what would happen to your body if you consumed nothing but fast food, candy bars, and soda for a decade. Eating a single candy bar isn't a big deal, but eating hundreds of candy bars is. Fortunately, the opposite is true as well. Small improvements in your diet, a little more exercise, and a little more sleep can have major effects on your health over time. Incremental augmentation is an example of the power of accumulation. If your offer improves with every iteration cycle, it won't be long before your offer is many times more valuable to your customers than it was before. Small changes to your value delivery process can save you a ton of time and energy in the long run. The more small improvements you make over time, the better your results. Amplification. Think of a typical can of soda. When cans were first used to sell beverages, they were cylindrical, flat-topped, and made of steel. Over time, steel was phased out in favor of aluminum, pull tabs were introduced to make opening easier, and the can was necked, tapered slightly at the top. Necking a can has two major effects. First, it makes it easier to drink from, which users like. Second, it reduces the amount of metal necessary to produce a structurally sound can. The walls of a typical beverage can are now around 90 micrometers thick instead of about 2 millimeters, saving an enormous amount of raw materials. According to the Can Manufacturers Institute, approximately 131 billion cans are manufactured every year in the United States. When you multiply the cost savings of modern can designs across billions of cans and several decades, a few very small changes have saved the beverage industry hundreds of billions of dollars. That's amplification. Making a small change to a scalable system produces a huge result. The effect of any improvement or system optimization is amplified by the size of the system. The larger the system, the larger the result. When McDonald's comes up with a new sandwich, they're not limited to just selling it in one of their stores. They can start selling it in all of their stores around the world. When Starbucks comes up with a new drink, it can be made available to customers in every Starbucks location extremely quickly. The best way to identify amplification opportunities is to look for things that are consistently duplicated or multiplied. If Starbucks found a way to produce a shot of espresso using fewer coffee beans, it would make a huge difference in the amount of coffee they'd need to buy. If they discovered a way to make that espresso shot more quickly, it would reduce the time it takes to serve a customer and increase the number of customers a single store could serve in an hour. Scalable systems amplify the results of small changes. Small changes to scalable systems produce massive results. Barrier to competition. How much attention are you paying to what your competitors are doing? The more time and energy you spend following your competition, the less time and energy you have to actually build your business. Think of a company like Apple. There's no other company in the technology world that focuses less on keeping up with what other companies are providing. Instead, they focus on building something completely new and remarkable, then perfecting it as much as possible. Apple's competitors, on the other hand, seem to be locked in a never-ending scramble to keep up. After Apple launched the iPhone in 2007, BlackBerry scrambled to create the Storm, which replicated many of the same features. By the time the Storm launched, the iPhone had already gone through several iteration cycles, making it very difficult for BlackBerry to compete. To date, Apple has sold over 50 million iPhones worldwide. Instead of trying to compete directly with commodity laptop manufacturers like Asus, HP, and Dell in the netbook category, Apple conspicuously avoided the market for years. That changed when the iPad was launched in 2010, an offer that redefined the market instead of competing directly with pre-existing netbooks on features. In the first 2 months of its existence, the company sold over 2 million units. By choosing to innovate instead of compete, Apple successfully captured a leadership share of a very competitive market. Every improvement you make to your value stream makes it harder for potential competitors to keep up. By increasing your ability to create and deliver value efficiently and effectively, you're simultaneously making it more difficult for competitors to compete with you by doing what you're doing. Every benefit you deliver and every customer you serve makes it harder for competitors to replicate you. Don't focus on competing. Focus on delivering even more value. Your competition will take care of itself. Force multiplier. One of the things that makes humans unique is our ability to create and use tools. Tools are important because they multiply the effect of physical force, thought, or attention. The more a tool amplifies or concentrates your effort, the more effective the tool. If you try pounding on a nail with your bare hands, you'll certainly be able to exert some force, but it won't be enough to drive the nail into something solid. Besides, you'll probably hurt your hand. Using a hammer multiplies the magnitude of the force you're exerting and concentrates that force into a very small area, making it easy to drive a nail in a single stroke. Saws, screwdrivers, and other tools work the same way. They amplify and concentrate the force you generate to produce more output. The most effective tools amplify force in the greatest magnitude. A power saw is far more effective at multiplying force than a handsaw is. A dump truck can carry more than a wheelbarrow. A rocket can launch a payload farther than a slingshot. Investing in force multipliers makes sense because you can get more done with the same amount of effort. If you need to dig the foundation to build a new house, a $10 shovel from your local hardware store will certainly work, but a backhoe will get the job done faster and easier. If building homes is your business, buying or leasing a backhoe is worth the cost. Force multipliers can be expensive. The more effective they are, the more expensive they tend to be. Factory production and distribution systems are examples of large-scale force multipliers. They make it possible to deliver value to thousands or millions of paying customers in a very short time. They may cost thousands or millions of dollars, but they can give you capabilities that would otherwise be out of reach. As a general rule, the only good use of debt or outside capital in setting up a system is to give you access to force multipliers you would not be able to access any other way. If your business requires tooling up a factory, you probably don't have $10 million sitting in your bank account. Taking a loan from a bank or accepting capital from an outside investor may be your best option, provided you use those funds to purchase and maintain force multipliers, not to pay yourself or maintain rent on a fancy office. Always choose the best tools that you can obtain and afford. Quality tools give you maximum output with a minimum of input. By investing in force multipliers, you free up your time, energy, and attention to focus on building your business instead of simply operating it. Systemization. Even if you make everything up as you go along, there is still a process involved, assuming that multiple steps are needed to get from point A to point B. Instead of constantly winging it, clarifying your process can provide a few major benefits. A system is a process made explicit and repeatable, a series of steps that has been formalized in some way. Systems can be written or diagrammed, but they are always externalized, which we'll discuss later, in some way. The primary benefit of creating a system is that you can examine the process and make improvements. By making each step in the process explicit, you can understand how the core processes work, how they're structured, how they affect other processes and systems, and how you can improve the system over time. Google is a great example of the power of systems. Every time you use the Google search engine, thousands of computers automatically spring into action to deliver your results. Google's search algorithm, a fancy programming word for system, defines how these computers work together, and Google employees are constantly refining the details of how the system works. Each year, Google engineers make over 550 improvements to the primary search engine algorithm, making it better able to point you to what you're looking for. As a result, the Google algorithm has become so efficient that your search results are returned in 0.2 seconds with zero human intervention. An astounding achievement. If Google hadn't spent most of their early time and energy defining and systematizing the search process, the company simply wouldn't exist. Systems also help teams of people stay on the same page. As we'll discuss in Chapter 8, communication is necessary for people to work well together, and the more people you're working with, the more communication you need. Developing systems and clear processes for certain events and tasks can help everyone do what must be done with a minimum of misunderstanding and fuss. If you can't systematize your process, you can't automate it. Imagine what it would be like if Google relied on a team of human librarians to generate search results. It'd be a nightmare. You'd wait days or weeks or months to get your results. The key to Google's quality and speed is automation. By explicitly defining the rules of how the system operates, the search engine programmers are able to automate the day-to-day operation of the system. As a result, Google developers are free to focus their efforts on continually improving the system instead of on operating the system. Most people resist creating business systems because it feels like extra work. We're all busy, and it's easy to feel like you don't have time to create and improve systems because there's already too much work to do. Actually, useful systems make your work easier. If you're feeling overloaded, the best thing you can do to solve the issue is to spend time creating good systems. Systemization and automation have a few major drawbacks, which we'll explore in detail in chapters 10 and 11. For now, recognize that effective systems are the lifeblood of a business. They allow you to create, market, sell, and ultimately deliver what you have to offer. The better your systems, the better your business. Chapter 5. Finance. In my experience, people enjoy learning about value creation, marketing, sales, and value delivery. They're easy to understand and visualize. When it comes to finance, however, eyes glaze over. Finance conjures up associations of bean counting, mathematical formulas, and spreadsheets overflowing with numbers. It doesn't have to be that way. Finance is quite easy to understand if you focus on what's most important. Finance is the art and science of watching money flowing into and out of a business, then deciding how to allocate it, and determining whether or not what you're doing is producing the results you want. Accounting is the process of ensuring the data you use to make financial decisions is as complete and accurate as possible. It's not really any more complicated than that. Yes, there can be fancy models and jargon, but ultimately you're simply using numbers to decide whether or not your business is operating the way you intended, and whether or not the results are enough. Every successful business must bring in a certain amount of money to keep going. If you're creating value, marketing, selling, and delivering value, there's money flowing into and out of the business every day. In order to continue to exist, every business must bring in sufficient revenue to justify all of the time and effort that goes into running the operation. Everyone has bills to pay and groceries to buy, so the people involved in the business need to consistently make enough money to justify the time and energy they're investing, or they'll quit and do something else. Accordingly, every business must capture some amount of the value it creates as revenue, which is then used to pay expenses and compensate the people who make the business run. The very best businesses create a virtuous cycle. They create huge amounts of value while keeping their expenses consistently low, so they make more than enough money to keep going without capturing too much value. As a result, they're able to simultaneously pad their pocketbooks and improve the lives of their customers, since the continued existence of the business makes everyone involved better off. Finance helps you watch your dollars in a way that makes sense. Profit. It doesn't matter if your business brings in $100 million a year in revenue if you spend $100 million. Business is not about what you make. It's about what you keep. Profit is a very simple concept. It's bringing in more money than you spend. In order for a business to continue to exist, the total revenue it collects must exceed the total expenses it accumulates at some point in the foreseeable future. If it doesn't, it'll cease to be a business. The operation will run out of resources and close, or it'll become a project subsidized by the profits of another business. Nothing can operate at a loss forever. Profit is important because it allows businesses to stay in operation. Without generating profits, a business can't compensate its owners, who may be investing considerable time, money, and energy into the operation. If the owners don't find their investment worthwhile, they'll simply close the business. Profit also provides a cushion that allows the business to weather unexpected events. If a business is barely generating enough revenue to cover its expenses, and those expenses suddenly rise, the business is in a great deal of trouble. The more profitable the business, the better it will be able to handle uncertainty and change, and the more options it has to respond to the unforeseeable. Profit is a very important consideration, but it's not the be-all and end-all of business. Some people believe that the purpose of a business is to maximize the amount of profits generated, but that's not the only reason businesses are created. For some people, like me, business is more of a creative endeavor, a way to explore what's possible, help others, and support yourself at the same time. From this perspective, as long as you're making enough profit, your business will continue to be successful. The concepts you'll learn in this chapter will help you ensure that your business creates enough profit to keep going. Profit margin. Profit margin, often abbreviated to margin, is the difference between how much revenue you capture and how much you spend to capture it, expressed in percentage terms. Here's the formula for profit margin. Revenue minus cost divided by revenue times 100 equals percent profit margin. If you spend $1 to get $2, that's a 50% profit margin. If you're able to create a product for $100 and sell it for $150, that's a profit of $50 and a profit margin of 33%. If you're able to sell the same product for $300, that's a margin of 66%. The higher the price and the lower the cost, the higher the profit margin. In any case, your profit margin can never exceed 100%, which only happens if you're able to sell something that cost you nothing. Profit margin is not the same as markup, which represents how the price of an offer compares to its total cost. Here's the formula for markup. Price minus cost divided by cost times 100 equals percent markup. If the cost of an offer is $1 and you sell it for $2, your markup is 100%, but your profit margin is only 50%. Margins can never be more than 100%, but markups can be 200%, 500%, or 10,000%, depending on the price and the total cost of your offer. The higher your price and the lower your cost, the higher your markup. Most businesses try to keep each offer's profit margin as high as possible, which makes sense. The higher the margin, the more money the business gets to keep from each sale. Regardless, there are many market pressures that can lead to a decline in margins over time. Aggressive pricing by competitors, new offers that decrease demand for older offers, and rising input costs. Businesses often use profit margin as a way of comparing offers. If a company has more than one offer in a market, it tends to favor the offers with the highest margins. If a business needs to cut costs, it often starts by eliminating offers with the lowest margins. When examining a business, pay close attention to profit margin. The higher the margin, the stronger the business. Value capture. Every business must capture some percentage of the value it creates in the form of revenue as profit. If it doesn't, the business will have a difficult time generating enough resources over time to continue operation. Value capture is the process of retaining some percentage of the value provided in every transaction. If you're able to offer another business something that will allow them to bring in $1 million of additional revenue and you charge $100,000, you're capturing 10% of the value created by the transaction. Value capture is tricky. In order to be successful, you need to capture enough value to make your investment of time and energy worthwhile, but not so much that there's no reason for your customers to do business with you. People buy because they believe they're getting more value in the transaction than they're spending. The more value you capture, the less attractive your offer becomes. Capture too much, and your prospects won't bother purchasing from you. Movies are great, but would you pay $5,000 for 2 hours of entertainment? There are two dominant philosophies behind value capture: maximization and minimization. Maximization, which is the approach taught in most business schools, means that a business should attempt to capture as much value as possible. Accordingly, the business should attempt to capture as much revenue in each transaction as possible. Capturing less than the maximum amount of value possible is unacceptable. In the short run, it's easy to see the appeal of maximization. More profit is a good thing for the owners of a company. Unfortunately, the maximization approach tends to erode the reason customers purchase from a business in the first place. Would you spend $999,999 in order to make $1 million? It may be rational. After all, you'd be $1 ahead. But most people won't bother. Customers purchase from you because they're receiving more value than they're giving up in the purchase. The less they receive, the less they'll want to buy from you. The minimization approach means that businesses should capture as little value as possible, as long as the business remains sufficient. While this approach may not bring in as much short-term revenue as maximization, it preserves the value customers see in doing business with the company, which is necessary for the business's long-term success. When something is a good deal, customers tend to continue to patronize the business and spread the word to other potential customers. When a business tries to maximize revenue by nickel and diming their customers or trying to capture too much value, customers flee. As long as you're bringing in enough to keep doing what you're doing, there's no need to fight for every last penny. Create as much value as you possibly can, then capture enough of that value to make it worthwhile to keep operating. Sufficiency. Once, a powerful executive went on vacation, his first in 15 years. As he was exploring a pier in a small coastal fishing village, a tuna fisherman docked his boat. As the fisherman lashed his boat onto the pier, the executive complimented him on the size and the quality of his fish. "How long did it take you to catch those fish?" the executive asked. "Only a little while," the fisherman replied. "Why don't you stay out longer and catch more?" the executive asked. "I have enough to support my family's needs," said the fisherman. "But," asked the executive, "what do you do with the rest of your time?" The fisherman replied, "I sleep late, fish a little, play with my children, take a siesta with my wife, and stroll into the village each evening, where I sip wine and play guitar with my friends. I have a full and busy life." The executive was flabbergasted. "I'm a Harvard MBA, and I can help you. You should spend more time fishing. With the proceeds, you could buy a bigger boat. A bigger boat would help you catch more fish, which you could sell to buy several boats. Eventually, you'd own an entire fleet. Instead of selling your catch to a middleman, you could sell directly to the consumers, which would improve your margins. Eventually, you could open your own factory, so you'd control the product, the processing, and the distribution. Of course, you'd have to leave this village and move to the city so you could run your expanding enterprise." The fisherman was quiet for a moment, then asked, "How long would this take?" 15, 20 years. 25 tops. "Then what?" The executive laughed. "That's the best part. When the time is right, you'd take your company public and sell all of your stock. You'd make millions." "Millions? What would I do then?" The executive paused for a moment. "You could retire, sleep late, fish a little, play with your children, take a siesta with your wife, and stroll into the village each evening to sip wine and play the guitar with your friends." Shaking his head, the executive said farewell to the fisherman. Immediately after returning from vacation, the executive resigned from his position. I'm not sure where this parable originated, but the message is useful. Business is not necessarily about maximizing profits. Profits are important, but they're a means to an end: creating value, paying expenses, compensating the people who run the business, and supporting yourself and your loved ones. Dollars aren't an end in themselves. Money is a tool, and the usefulness of that tool depends on what you intend to do with it. Your business does not have to bring in millions or billions of dollars to be successful. If you have enough profit to do the things you need to do to keep the business running and make it worth your time, you're successful, no matter how much revenue your business brings in. Sufficiency is the point where a business is bringing in enough profit that the people who are running the business find it worthwhile to keep going for the foreseeable future. Paul Graham, venture capitalist and founder of Y Combinator, an early-stage venture capital firm, calls the point of sufficiency ramen profitable, being profitable enough to pay your rent, keep the utilities running, and buy inexpensive food like ramen noodles. You may not be raking in millions of dollars, but you have enough revenue to keep building your venture without going under. You can't create value if you can't pay the bills. If you're not bringing in sufficient revenue to cover the operating expenses, that's a major issue. In order to keep going, you must be able to pay the employees and the owners for the time, effort, and attention they're giving to the venture. If these people don't find their investment sufficiently worthwhile, they'll stop doing what they're doing and start doing something else. You can track financial sufficiency using a number called Target Monthly Revenue, abbreviated TMR. Since employees, contractors, and vendors are typically paid on a monthly basis, it's relatively simple to calculate how much money you'll need to pay out each month. Your target monthly revenue helps you determine whether or not you've reached the point of sufficiency. As long as you bring in more than your TMR, you're sufficient. If not, you have work to do. Sufficiency is subjective. How much is enough to continue what you're doing is a personal decision. If your financial needs are meager, you don't need that much revenue to keep going. If you're spending millions of dollars on payroll, office space, and expensive systems, you'll need much more revenue to maintain sufficiency. The more quickly you can reach the point of sufficiency, the better the chance your business will survive and thrive. The more revenue you generate and the less money you spend, the quicker you will reach the point of sufficiency. Once you reach the point of sufficiency, you're successful, no matter how much or how little money you make. Valuation. We've talked about how to estimate the value of an offer, but how do you calculate the worth of a company? Valuation is an estimate of the total worth of a company. The higher a business's revenues, the stronger the company's profit margins, the higher its bank balance, and the more promising its future, the higher its valuation. Many companies base their financial decisions on what will increase the business's valuation. Higher estimates of value are beneficial for many reasons. If a company is private, having a high valuation makes it easier to borrow money. If the company is public, a high valuation leads to a high share price and a profit opportunity for the shareholders. If another business seeks to acquire the company, a high valuation leads to a big payday for the business's owners or shareholders. Valuation is also important if you intend to take on investors. The amount of capital you raise, as well as the total amount of ownership you give to your investors in exchange, depends on the business's current valuation at the time of investment. The higher the business's valuation, the more money you'll be able to command for every share you sell to the investor. If you're interested in how this works, I recommend the book Venture Deals by Brad Feld and Jason Mendelsohn. It's important to note that perceived value applies just as much to businesses as it does to individual offers. When people believe a company has bright future prospects, the company's valuation increases. If people believe the company is in trouble, the valuation decreases. This dynamic explains why some companies, like Amazon.com, have share prices equal to over 100 times the company's most recent earnings per share report, while troubled companies sometimes sell for less than the liquidation value of their current assets. Valuation is important to consider if you intend to sell shares of the company to investors or are positioning your business for future acquisition. If you own your own business and never intend to sell it, valuation considerations become less important. If you're an executive of a public company, building a business you'd like to sell someday, or investing your capital in a company, valuation may be on the top of your mind every day. The cash flow statement. In order to understand how well a company is performing, it's useful to look at financial reports that track the business's performance. Where should you begin? I recommend starting with the cash flow statement. We'll examine the other basic types of financial statements in a moment, but examining the cash flow statement is the best place to begin. The cash flow statement is straightforward. It's an examination of a company's bank account over a certain period of time. Think of it like a checking account ledger. Deposits of cash flow in and withdrawals of cash flow out. Ideally, more money flows in than flows out, and the total never goes below zero. Every cash flow statement covers a specific period of time. A day, a month, a year. The time period of the report depends on the purpose. Shorter periods, like days and weeks, are useful for making sure the company doesn't run out of cash. Longer periods, like months and years, are useful for tracking performance over time. Cash tends to move in three primary areas: operations, selling offers and buying inputs, investing, collecting dividends and paying for capital expenses, and financing, borrowing money and paying it back. Cash flow statements usually track these sources separately to make it easy to see where the cash flows come from. The nice thing about cash is that it doesn't lie. Barring outright fraud, cash is either in the bank account or it's not. If the company spends a lot of money but less is coming in, the business's cash position will decrease over time. There's little room for quote-unquote creative interpretation. Many investors use a metric called free cash flow when evaluating companies. This metric comes from the cash flow statement. It's the amount of cash a business collects from operations minus cash spent for capital equipment and assets, which are necessary to keep the company operating. The higher a company's free cash flow, the better. It means the business doesn't have to keep investing huge amounts of capital in order to continue bringing in money. In every business, cash represents options. The option to create a new offer, invest in marketing and sales, hire employees, purchase equipment, acquire another company, etc. As a general rule, the more cash your business has, the more options it has, and the more resilient the business becomes. Income statement. Cash is important, but it's not the whole picture. Cash is not profit, and profit is what we're after. It's possible to have a nice, comfortable cash position for a while, but lose money with every sale. Imagine a retailer that buys products from a manufacturer on credit. It receives inventory, but doesn't have to pay the manufacturer for 90 days. For 3 months, the sales roll in, and the retailer's cash position grows and grows. To the untrained eye, things look great. After 90 days, the manufacturer's invoice comes due. When you total the costs of the products and the retailer's operating expenses, you discover the truth. The company lost money, even though the cash balance looked great for 3 months. If the retailer doesn't do something, it'll eventually run out of money and close. Businesses can't exist without profits for long. The retailer's error was relying on cash accounting without understanding the limitations. For many types of businesses, cash accounting is ideal. It's simple and easy to understand. As long as you bring in more cash than you spend and you don't run out of money, life is good. I've run my businesses using cash accounting for years. I get paid immediately when I provide products and services, and I don't have an inventory to manage. My business isn't complicated, so my accounting and financial tracking don't need to be complicated. For other businesses, relying on a cash flow statement isn't enough. If the business manages an inventory or extends credit to customers, a simple cash flow analysis can be misleading. In order to determine whether or not your sales are profitable, you need to be able to track which sales and expenses are related. By matching each sale with the expenses incurred in the process of making that sale, it's possible to see if you're making a profit immediately, without unpleasant surprises. First, the company must change the way it accounts for expenses. Instead of recording revenue when cash flows in and an expense when cash flows out, the company begins tracking revenue and expenses on what's called an accrual basis. In accrual accounting, revenue is recognized immediately when a sale is made, like a product is purchased, a service is rendered, etc., and the expenses associated with that sale are incurred in the same time period. Accountants call this the matching principle, and one of the primary jobs of an accountant is to match revenue and expenses as accurately as possible. This is harder than it sounds. An incredible amount of judgment is required, and ambiguous areas are common. If you've ever wondered what accountants do all day, this is a big part of the job. The end result of this effort is an income statement, which is sometimes called a profit and loss statement, operating statement, or earnings statement. Regardless of the label, the income statement contains an estimate of the business's profit over a certain period of time, once revenue is matched with the related expenses. The general format for an income statement looks like this. Revenue minus cost of goods sold, revenue minus cost of goods sold, minus expenses, minus taxes, equals net profit. Income statements are very useful. There's a reason businesses go to the trouble of creating them. By matching expenses with revenue, it's easier to look at the company's profitability and make decisions that will improve the company's bank account in the weeks and months to come. That said, it's important to recognize that income statements, by nature, include many estimates and assumptions. They have to. Large expenses like equipment purchases may involve a huge cash outlay, but the income statement attributes a small piece of the expense to each sales period, a practice called amortization, which we'll discuss later. This practice helps match the expense to the associated revenue. Looking at a huge negative cash flow statement for that period would be misleading. The matching principle, for all of its benefits, introduces many sources of potential bias in the income statement. By changing when revenue is recognized and how expenses are matched to that revenue, accountants and finance professionals can make the profit line of the statement skyrocket or implode by changing a few assumptions or formulas. Exploring every source of potential bias in the income statement is way beyond the scope of this book. If you're interested in more detail on this topic, I highly recommend the book Financial Intelligence for Entrepreneurs by Karen Berman and Joe Knight. If you expect your business needs accrual accounting to generate an accurate income statement, don't do it yourself. Talk to a CPA or a CFA as soon as possible. The more accurate and reliable your income statement is, the better you'll be able to manage your business. Money well spent. Balance sheet. A balance sheet is a snapshot of what a business owns and what it owes at a particular moment in time. You can think of it as an estimate of the company's net worth at the time the balance sheet was created. Balance sheets always cite a specific day and use this calculation. Assets minus liabilities equals owner's equity. Assets are things the company owns that have value, products, equipment, stock, etc. Liabilities are obligations the firm hasn't yet discharged, loans, financing, etc. What's left over when you discharge all of the company's liabilities is owner's equity, the company's net worth. For smaller businesses, the balance sheet is pretty straightforward. Count your cash on hand, add the estimated market value of any assets you own, and subtract all debt and current obligations. Voila, you've created a basic balance sheet. For larger businesses, the balance sheet is more complicated, and there are more entries to keep track of. Common assets include cash, accounts receivable, which is credit you've extended to customers, inventory, equipment, and property. Common liabilities include long and short-term debt, accounts payable, which is credit that other firms have extended to you, and other obligations. Owner's equity includes the value of the company's stock, capital from investors, and retained earnings, which is profit that hasn't been paid to the company's shareholders. What makes the balance sheet balance is the secondary form of the equation, which is a rearrangement of the first equation. Assets equals liabilities plus owner's equity. This calculation looks odd at first. Why would you ever want to add liabilities and owner's equity? Here's why. When a business borrows money, it receives the amount of cash borrowed. That goes on the cash flow statement, and the influx of money makes it look like the business had a very good month if you don't realize it's a loan. When you think about it, the company's financial picture didn't really change. The business now has more assets, more cash, but it also has a new liability, more debt. The company's net worth didn't change at all. The second formula is useful because it reflects this relationship. Let's assume you're starting a business and you borrow $10,000. Before you borrow the money, your balance sheet looks like this. 0 equals 0 plus 0. You have no assets, no liabilities, and no equity. After you borrow the money, your balance sheet looks like this. $10,000 equals $10,000 plus 0. You have $10,000 in assets, $10,000 in liabilities, and no equity. Both sides of the balance sheet are the same. The balance sheet always balances. If it doesn't balance, you've made an error. Since balance sheets are snapshots of a moment in time, it's common to review several of them at a time. For example, a company might include balance sheets calculated on the last day of its fiscal year for the past 2 or 3 years. By comparing balance sheets, it's easy to see how assets, liabilities, and owner's equity have changed over time. Balance sheets are valuable because they answer many important questions about the financial health of a business. By examining a company's balance sheet, you can determine whether or not the company is solvent, that is, its assets are greater than its liabilities, if it's having trouble paying its bills, or how the company's value has changed over time. Balance sheets, just like income statements, are full of assumptions and estimates that can introduce bias in the numbers. What's the value of a brand name or a reputation? What percentage of the company's accounts receivable will actually be paid? How valuable is the business's current inventory? Don't skip the footnotes. By examining the assumptions behind the entries on the balance sheet, you'll develop a more accurate picture of the strength of the business. Financial ratios. Once you've compiled your business's basic financial reports, you can examine them in many different ways. One of the most effective strategies is to calculate a financial ratio, a comparison of two important elements of your business. Financial ratios are beneficial because they allow you to make comparisons very quickly. Instead of poring through data in the financial reports manually, looking at a financial ratio helps you decide at a glance whether or not certain parts of the business are healthy. Looking at how these ratios change over time helps you see how the business is changing over time. Comparing the ratios to industry averages makes it easy to see if the company is performing like a typical company in the industry, or if something is odd. Profitability ratios indicate a business's ability to generate profit. The higher your revenue and the lower your costs, the higher your profitability ratios. We've already discussed profit margin, which is a very basic profitability ratio. Return on assets, which is calculated by dividing net profit by total assets, tells you what percentage of every dollar invested in the business was returned as profit. Leverage ratios indicate how your company uses debt. Debt-to-equity ratios, which are calculated by dividing total liabilities by shareholders' equity, tell you how many dollars a company has borrowed for every $1 in owner's equity. If the ratio is high, it's a signal the company is highly leveraged, which is a bad sign. Other ratios, like interest coverage, calculate how much of the business's profit goes to pay off interest on debt. Other ratios, like interest coverage, calculate how much of the business's profit goes to pay off interest on debt. Liquidity ratios indicate the ability of a business to pay its bills. Running out of cash is a serious issue, so ratios like the current ratio, current assets divided by current liabilities, and the quick ratio, current assets minus inventory divided by current liabilities, makes it easy to determine how close a company is to bankruptcy, or if the business is sitting on cash instead of investing money in growth or improvement. Efficiency ratios indicate how well a business is managing assets and liabilities. The most common use is inventory management. Having too little inventory is a bad thing, but having too much is also bad. Calculating the average number of days an item is in inventory, how long it takes to sell out current inventory, and day sales outstanding, a measure of how long it takes to collect the cash from sales, are helpful when making changes in production, managing inventory on hand, and planning future capital investments. There are thousands of different types of financial ratios, and covering them all is way beyond the scope of this book. Financial analysts tend to choose a small set of important ratios based on the industry. It makes no sense to calculate inventory turns for a barbershop. Every business has a small number of important ratios to consider. It's worthwhile to do a bit of research to see what they are for your industry. We'll discuss other ratios in Chapter 10. The technique is useful in many areas outside of finance. For now, remember that financial ratios are used to check profit, debt, cash, and efficiency without spending too much time. Cost-benefit analysis. The purpose of financial analysis isn't to produce impressive-looking spreadsheets. It's to make better decisions. If the data you're examining doesn't lead to changes that improve your business, you're wasting your time. The core of finance is examining a potential action, consulting the data you have at your disposal, and deciding what, if anything, to do. Cost-benefit analysis is the process of examining potential changes to your business to see if the benefits outweigh the costs. Instead of acting on a change the moment you think of it, you take a step back to evaluate the true cost of the action and whether or not you believe it's the best thing you can do with your limited time, energy, and resources. When conducting a cost-benefit analysis, it's important to include costs and benefits that aren't purely financial. Non-economic costs, like enjoyment, can play a large role in whether or not a project is worth pursuing. Google's famous cafeteria benefits are a great example. The company provides free, high-quality food to employees around the clock. This policy looks like a huge cost until you consider the benefit. By providing breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks, the company is encouraging employees to be at work as much as possible. The cost is offset by the increase in productivity and team cohesion, which is very significant. Removing chronic frustrations and small inefficiencies can be just as beneficial. I recently spent a few $100s to upgrade my computer's hard disk to a solid-state drive that is 6 times faster. My applications and programs now launch instantly, instead of requiring a 5 to 10 second wait. That doesn't sound like much, but small improvements accumulate over time. I spend most of my work time on the computer, and it's a huge difference. I'm happier, and I'm getting more work done. Money well spent. Before making a decision, evaluate the total costs and benefits. A little evaluation will ensure you spend your money in the most effective ways. 4 methods to increase revenue. Believe it or not, there are only 4 ways to increase your business's revenue. Number 1, increase the number of customers you serve. Number 2, increase the average size of each transaction by selling more. Number 3, increase the frequency of transactions per customer. Or number 4, raise your prices. Imagine you're operating a restaurant and you want to increase the amount of revenue that your restaurant brings in. Here's how to apply these strategies. Number 1, increasing the number of customers means you're trying to bring more people in the door. This strategy is relatively straightforward. More visitors to your restaurant will equal more tabs, which, assuming the average transaction size stays the same, will bring in more money. Number 2, increasing average transaction size means you're trying to get each customer to purchase more. This is typically done through a process called upselling. When a customer purchases an entree, you offer them appetizers, drinks, and dessert. The more of these items the customer purchases, the more they spend, and the more revenue you collect. Number 3, increasing the frequency of transactions per customer means encouraging people to purchase from you more often. If your average customer comes in once a month, convincing them to patronize your business once a week will increase your revenue. The more frequently they visit your establishment, the more revenue your restaurant will bring in, assuming the average transaction size stays the same. And number 4, raising your prices means you'll collect more revenue from every purchase a customer makes. Assuming your volume, average transaction size, and frequency stay the same, raising your prices will bring in more revenue for the same amount of effort. Remember the lesson of qualification. Not every customer is a good customer. Some customers will sap your time, energy, and resources without providing the results you're looking for. If you're spending a lot of energy serving customers who don't come in often, have a low average transaction size, don't spread the word and complain about the price, it doesn't make sense to attract more of those customers. Always focus the majority of your efforts on serving your ideal customers. Your ideal customers buy early, buy often, spend the most, spread the word, and are willing to pay a premium for the value you provide. The more ideal customers you can attract, the better your business. Pricing power. Imagine doubling your current prices. If you'd lose less than half of your customers, it's probably a good move. Pricing power is your ability to raise the prices you're charging over time. The less value you're capturing, the greater your pricing power. Serving customers takes time, energy, and resources. The more you earn per customer served, the better your business. Changing your prices can help you maximize your results while minimizing your effort and investment. Pricing power is related to a concept economists call price elasticity. If customers are very sensitive to the price of your offer, you'll lose many customers with even a slight increase in price, meaning demand is elastic. Established semi-commodity markets like toothpaste are good examples. Unless you're able to create something new and unique that customers badly want, dramatically increasing your prices is a good way to ensure that everyone stops buying your product and starts buying from your competitor. If your customers aren't price sensitive, you could quadruple the price with little change in sales. Take luxury goods, for example. Customers purchase them because they're expensive social signals that are exclusive because they're costly. Increasing the price of designer handbags, clothing, and watches is likely to make those items more desirable, not less. Economists like to spend time graphing and calculating price elasticity, but it's not necessary. Unless you already have accurate norms, you can't really know how much pricing power you have until you actually change your prices and watch what happens. Fortunately, unless you're an established player in a large and active market, in which case you'll have norms to work with, changing your prices very rarely has permanent effects unless your prices are broadly publicized and scrutinized. You can experiment to find what works. Pricing power is important because raising your prices allows you to overcome the adverse effects of inflation and increased cost. Historically, currency issued by any government tends to decrease in value over time. There are many strong incentives for officials to increase the supply of currency, which debases that currency's purchasing power. As a result, it takes more currency to purchase the same products and services necessary to stay in business, increasing your business's sufficiency needs. Without adequate pricing power, your business may not be able to remain sufficient in the face of higher expenses. The higher the prices you can command, the more reliably you'll be able to maintain profit sufficiency. If you have a choice, choose a market in which you'll have pricing power. It'll be much easier to maintain sufficiency over time. Lifetime value. Imagine operating a lemonade stand on the sidewalk of a popular tourist destination. Each cup of lemonade costs $1. You may be busy serving customers, but each customer you serve is just passing by. You'll probably never see them again. Contrast that with the insurance business. Assume the average customer pays a premium of $200 per month for car insurance. That's $2,400 in premiums per year. If the average customer remains with the same insurance agency for 10 years, each client is worth $24,000 in premium payments over the lifetime of their relationship with the company. That's a huge difference. Lifetime value is the total value of a customer's business over the lifetime of their relationship with your company. The more a customer purchases from you and the longer they stay with you, the more valuable that customer is to your business. One of the reasons subscriptions are so profitable is that they naturally maximize lifetime value. Instead of making a single sale to a customer, subscription businesses focus on providing value and collecting revenue for as long as possible. The longer a customer remains subscribed and the higher the price they pay, the higher the lifetime value of that customer. The higher your average customer's lifetime value, the better your business. By understanding how much your average customer purchases and how long they tend to buy from you, you can place a tangible value on each new customer, which helps you make good decisions. Losing a single lemonade stand customer isn't a huge deal. Losing an insurance client is. All told, it's much better to operate in markets where customers have a high lifetime value. The higher the lifetime value of your customer, the more you can do to keep them happy, and the more you can focus on serving customers well. Maintain a long-term relationship with profitable customers, and you win. Allowable acquisition cost. Think back to the lemonade stand. How much could you spend to attract a single paying customer? Not much. You're only earning $1 per cup of lemonade, so you can't afford to spend much on marketing to individuals. Contrast that with the insurance agency. If the lifetime value of a customer is $24,000, how much could you spend to attract a new customer? Much more. Getting people's attention and acquiring new prospects typically costs time and resources. Once you understand the lifetime value of a prospect, you can calculate the maximum amount of time and resources you're willing to spend to acquire a new prospect. Allowable acquisition cost is the marketing component of lifetime value. The higher the average customer's lifetime value, the more you can spend to attract a new customer, making it possible to spread the word about your offer in new ways. Having a high lifetime value even allows you to lose money on the first sale. Guthrie Renker sells a topical acne treatment called Proactive, using long-form television infomercials, which are expensive. They hire celebrity endorsers like Jessica Simpson and spend millions to produce and air those commercials. At first glance, it doesn't make any sense. The first sale is for the low, low price of $20. How on earth are they not losing money hand over fist? The answer is subscription. When a customer purchases Proactive, they aren't just buying a single bottle of face goo. They're signing up to receive a bottle every month in exchange for a recurring payment. The lifetime value of each new Proactive customer is so high that it doesn't matter that Guthrie Renker goes negative on the initial sale. The company makes a ton of money, even if it loses money on a few customers who don't continue with the program. The first sale is sometimes called a loss leader, an enticing offer intended to establish a relationship with a new customer. Many subscription businesses use loss leaders to build their subscriber base. Magazines like Sports Illustrated offer gimmicks like football phones and spend a fortune on their annual swimsuit edition in an effort to attract new subscribers. These enticements may absorb up to a year's worth of subscription revenue, but the company comes out ahead when you consider the lifetime value of each customer. Each new subscriber allows Sports Illustrated to charge their advertisers higher prices, which provides the bulk of the company's revenue. To calculate your market's allowable acquisition cost, start with your average customer's lifetime value, then subtract your value stream costs, what it takes to create and deliver the value promised to that customer over your entire relationship with them. Then, subtract your business's overhead divided by your total customer base, which represents the fixed costs you'll need to pay to stay in business over that period of time. Multiply the result by 1 minus your desired profit margin. So if you're shooting for a 60% profit margin, you'd use 1 minus 0.6 equals 0.4, and that's your allowable acquisition cost. Here's an example. If your average lifetime value is $2,000 over a 5-year period, and the cost of value creation and delivery is $500, that leaves you with $1,500 in revenue per customer served. Assuming your overhead expenses are $500,000 over the same 5-year period of time, and you have 500 customers, your fixed costs are $1,000 per customer, which leaves you in $500 in revenue before marketing expenses. Assuming you're shooting for a minimum 60% profit margin, you can afford to spend 40% of that $500 on marketing, which gives you a maximum allowable acquisition cost of $200 per customer. Knowing that, you can test various forms of marketing to see if they work. If your assumptions are correct, any customer you can attract for $200 or less will be worth the investment. The higher the lifetime value of your customers, the higher the allowable acquisition cost. The more each new subscriber is worth to your business, the more you can spend